Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Per Curiam Habeas Decision Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On November 6, 2017, the Supreme Court issued per curiam decisions in Kernan v. Quero and Dunn v. Madison, both cases involving habeas petitions filed by state prisoners. In this episode, we will be discussing both decisions. Up first is Kernan v. Quero. Michael Quero pled guilty to two felony charges on the understanding that the maximum prison sentence he faced was 14 years and 4 months. In the course of making his plea, Quero admitted to a previous conviction for residential burglary, which qualified as a predicate offense or strike under California's three strikes law. After the plea, but before sentencing, however, the prosecution realized that another of Quero's previous convictions counted as a second such strike. Over Quero's objection, the trial court granted the prosecution's motion to amend its criminal complaint to add the additional strike, but also permitted Quero to withdraw his guilty plea in light of the change. He ultimately entered a new guilty plea to the amended complaint, and the presence of the second strike exposed him to an enhanced sentence of a minimum of 25 years and a maximum of life imprisonment. Quero was then sentenced to 25 years to life. The conviction and sentence were affirmed on direct appeal, and a state habeas petition was denied by the California Supreme Court. Quero then sought habeas relief in federal district court, which denied his petition. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, however, reversed that judgment and held that the state trial court had acted contrary to clearly established Supreme Court law by refusing to enforce the original plea agreement with its 14 years and 4 months maximum sentence. On November 9th, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit and remanded the case. In a per curiam opinion, the court held that the Ninth Circuit had erred when it held that federal law, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, clearly established that specific performance of the original plea agreement was constitutionally required. Our next case is Dunn v. Madison. In 2016, Vernon Madison petitioned an Alabama trial court to stay his death sentence after a series of recent strokes which, he argued, left him incompetent to be executed. Madison has been awaiting his death sentence since the 1980s, when he was convicted of capital murder. In Ford v. Wainwright and Panetti v. Quarterman, the Supreme Court indicated that a person is entitled to relief if it could be proven that he suffers from a mental illness which deprives him of the mental capacity to rationally understand that he is being executed as a punishment for a crime. The trial court held a hearing to consider the testimony of two psychologists, one court-appointed and the other hired by Madison's counsel. Although they acknowledged that Madison's mental awareness and memory of past events may have declined post-stroke, both psychologists indicated that he could understand that Alabama was seeking retribution against him for his criminal act. The trial court denied Madison's petition. Madison then sought habeas relief in federal district court, claiming that the state court had incorrectly applied Ford and Panetti and that his judgment was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented. The district court denied relief, but a divided panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit granted a certificate of appealability and reversed. As Madison no longer remembers committing his capital offense, the 11th Circuit reasoned, he cannot rationally understand the connection between his crime and his execution. The U.S. Supreme Court thereafter reversed the judgment of the 11th Circuit, explaining in a per curiam opinion that neither Panetti nor Ford clearly established that a prisoner is incompetent to be executed because of a failure to remember his commission of the crime, as distinct from a failure to rationally comprehend the concepts of crime and punishment as applied in this case. The state court, the Supreme Court held, did not apply Panetti or Ford unreasonably, nor rely upon an unreasonable assessment of the evidence before it. Madison, therefore, was not entitled to federal habeas relief. Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, issued a concurring opinion. Justice Breyer also issued a concurring opinion. And now, to discuss these cases, we have Kent Scheidegger, Legal Director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation.
On November 6th, the United States Supreme Court issued the first two decisions of its current term. To the surprise of no one who watches the court regularly, Both cases involve the failure of federal courts of appeals to respect the limits that Congress has placed on their authority to overturn the decisions of state courts in criminal cases. The power of the lower federal courts to use the writ of habeas corpus to review the decisions of state courts in criminal matters has ebbed and flowed throughout American history, depending largely on the confidence that Congress and the Supreme Court have had in the state courts versus the federal courts, and on the ability of the Supreme Court itself to correct any errors in the state courts. Early in our history, federal courts and habeas corpus had no authority to review state convictions at all. From 1953 to 1996, a federal court sitting in habeas corpus would decide for itself any questions of federal law presented by the petitioner, without deferring to any previous decision in the case by the state courts. This de novo review may well have been necessary in the 50s and 60s, when there was widespread resistance in the states to federal authority and to the criminal procedure decisions of the Warren Court, but by the 1990s it served largely to give a criminal defendant a heads-I-win, tails-we-take-it-over form of review. For capital cases in particular, many sentences that were lawfully and justly imposed were overturned on grounds that could later be seen to be wrong in light of later Supreme Court decisions. When Congress enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, it considered and rejected both the existing de novo review and the opposite position of treating the state court decision as conclusive. Congress instead chose a middle ground of requiring the federal courts to respect the state court decision unless it was, quote, contrary to or involved in a reasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court. This provision has met with massive resistance from many federal judges, and reversing their failure to observe it has occupied a substantial portion of the Supreme Court's docket for the last 20 years. Many of these reversals have been issued summarily, meaning that the Court of Appeals decision is so obviously wrong that the court does not even need to take briefing on the merits or hear oral argument, and many of them have been unanimous. Both are true of the November 6th decisions. Kernan v. Cuero is a prime example of why Congress felt the need to abolish the old de novo review rule. Cuero had a long criminal history that included convictions for residential burglary and assault with a deadly weapon. In the current case, he was charged with driving under the influence of methamphetamine, resulting in a crash which severely injured another person, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. He pleaded guilty to charges indicating that only the burglary conviction was a strike under California's three strikes law, and that his maximum sentence would be 14 years and 4 months in prison. After his plea was accepted, but before sentencing and entry of judgment, the error of not counting the assault with a deadly weapon conviction as a strike was discovered. Longstanding California law permits amendment of the complaint after a plea in order to correctly reflect prior convictions. Applying this statute, the trial judge allowed the prosecution to amend the complaint and allowed the defendant to withdraw the plea. The decision was affirmed on appeal, and all three levels of California courts denied habeas corpus petitions. A federal magistrate judge found that Cuero's habeas corpus petition was meritless, and the federal district judge agreed. Yet, two of the three members of the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit found merit in the petition and overturned the judgment. The panel majority said that the state courts had acted contrary to clearly established Supreme Court law by refusing to enforce the original plea agreement, and that specific performance of the original agreement was required. The full Ninth Circuit denied rehearing in banc over the dissent of seven of its judges. The Supreme Court reversed, holding that its own precedents do not establish anything of the sort. In Santobello v. New York, the court held a defendant could not be held to his side of the plea agreement while the prosecution breached its side, but it specifically left to the state courts the question of whether specific performance or allowing the defendant to withdraw his plea was the appropriate remedy. The court also noted that, quote, the Ninth Circuit also pointed in support to its own circuit precedent, a criminal procedure treatise, a decision of the Washington Supreme Court, and a law review article, end quote. But the California courts are not obligated to follow any of these authorities, and for that reason Congress specifically provided that only a violation of clearly established federal law, as determined by the Supreme Court, will undermine a state court decision. The Supreme Court noted that it has repeatedly pointed out that circuit precedents do not have the same force under this law as Supreme Court precedents. And, the court added, open quote, nor, of course, do state court decisions, treatises, or law review articles, end quote. The tone of the Supreme Court's opinion is severe, and appropriately so. Not only do panels of federal courts of appeals repeatedly exceed the statutory limits of their authority, as determined by an act of Congress and Supreme Court precedent, but the full courts in some circuits regularly fail to rein in their rogue panels. This problem has been particularly severe in the Ninth, Sixth, and Third Circuits, but it is not limited to them, as the second case decided the same day illustrates. In Mobile, Alabama, in 1985, Vernon Madison sneaked up behind police officer Julius Schulte and shot him twice in the head. After delaying the execution of his death sentence for many years, with appeals and habeas corpus proceedings, the time for execution finally approached. Madison then claimed that as a result of strokes, he was incompetent to be executed. The Supreme Court's precedents in Ford v. Wainwright in 1986 and Panetti v. Quarterman in 2007 established that a person cannot be executed if he lacks the, quote, mental capacity to rationally understand that he is being executed as a punishment for a crime, end quote. Both the court-appointed expert and Madison's own expert testified that he knew he was in prison for murder and was going to be executed for the murder. But Madison's expert said he did not remember the crime and trial. Madison's claim that Ford and Panetti precluded his execution was rejected by the state courts and by the federal district court, but a divided panel of the 11th Circuit reversed. The state petitioned for rehearing en banc, but no judge of the 11th Circuit called for a vote. After reciting the facts and procedural history, the Supreme Court needed only one paragraph to dispose of the key legal issue. Neither Ford nor Panetti establishes a rule of law that a person who understands why he is being executed but cannot remember the crime is constitutionally incompetent. That question remains open, and the state courts did not unreasonably interpret the Supreme Court precedents. There was no dissent. Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, noted only that the underlying question remained open. Justice Breyer added another concurring opinion, questioning the constitutionality of the long delays in executing the death penalty, with no mention of the extent to which the federal courts have caused those delays. No other justice joined this opinion. The unanimity of the Supreme Court, despite the broad spectrum of views among its nine justices, illustrates that the Court of Appeals panel opinion in this case was clearly wrong. Yet, the full 11th Circuit failed to correct it. Under the compromise enacted by Congress, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, the state court decision stands unless its determinations of law and fact are so lacking in justification as to give rise to error beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement. Such unquestionably wrong decisions are rare, and federal court judgments overturning state criminal convictions should be correspondingly rare. Until the federal courts of appeals respect this rule of law, and until the full courts police their own panels, this issue will continue to take up an inordinate portion of the Supreme Court's workload.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.